But what happened was, as an example, from 1347 to 1351, half the white people on earth died from plague, from pneumonic plagues, bubonic plague, you call it. Some people cripple and say, well, it's only a third. Well, in 4 years, well, whether it was a third or half, that's a lot of the population. And you know that if half the population died in 4 years period of time, or a third of the population, you can imagine what that means for any kind of economy that you got. I mean, because the disease was non-discriminatory, it killed everybody. And in fact, it was frightening to Europeans, so that people would actually leave relatives where they fell because they didn't want to be contaminated by and run away from it. Europe, you know the song, Ring Around the Roses, Pocket Full of Poses. It came from that period. And because the disease on the skins of white people looked like a rose with a ring around. The poses, the pocket full of flowers, was to cover the stench of rotting flesh and dying people all over the place. And for something like at least the next 50 years, there was an actual decline in the population of Europe. So this notion that I was taught in school, that Europeans were trying to cure some kind of intellectual itch by setting off in ships to explore the world to cure some kind of curiosity that they had is nonsense. It was poverty and disease that chased Europe out of Europe, and they went on looting expeditions everywhere. And you can read any of the old texts. You can read even things written diaries of some of the conquistadors. About when the Spaniards came, and what they did, Mexico is a great example. When they said they had never seen anything so beautiful. This is the diary of a conquistador.
Yes.
So I've never seen anything so beautiful. They say it's a city on a lake, you know, and that the place is incredible with domesticated, you know, things like parrots and, you know, living in houses with people. Just magnificent. They destroyed it all. They came in and destroyed every bit of it in the coolest way. And this became a part of the foundation of the of this conquest, of the theft of the gold, the silver, etc., that changed this disease-ridden, impoverished Europe. It was the trade in African bodies. It was the theft of this land throughout the Americas. It was the, as I said, the opium war and things like that. That saw this tremendous transfer of resources, leaving wealthy places, places which were wealthy, on the one hand, going to this impoverished place. This was the basis for things like the Industrial Revolution in Europe. And it was also the basis for political revolution that occurred throughout Europe. The so-called, how did they characterize them, democratic revolutions, you know, that we were told came about as a consequence of people like John Locke and Rousseau writing these wonderful treatises on freedom, etc. No, what happened was a whole new social force emerged of people who were pirates and, if you will, entrepreneurs who were setting out, and they were becoming rich as a consequence of it. So rich that they acquired more resources than the nobility, than the old feudal nobility. And what you have to remember is this. When we met these guys, they had no freedom. They lived in feudal situation. There was no such thing as white people owning their own houses and properties. It didn't exist. They lived on the land of the landlord. They had nothing when we met them. And what happened was, and when we met them, we had everything. We had freedom. Generally speaking, this is a truth. And we had resources. We didn't have private property as such, generally speaking, because it didn't make sense. You know, I mean, this concept of private property is just illogical. That somebody can put a fence around something and grow it around an apple orchard, and then say, now if you want an apple, you gotta pay for what nature has provided. Just illogical. You know, it was just illogical. And so we didn't have, generally speaking, private property in that way. But we had resources. The land was collectively ours, generally speaking. That was the reality. And so you have this Europe that now has taken these resources. And now that these resources go there, it changes Europe, it changes the world. It begins this industrial revolution is something that set off as a consequence of that. The political revolution in Europe happens as a consequence of that, because there's a whole new, and economic, there's a whole new social force now that becomes wealthier than the nobility and gets and enters into a contest with the nobility for the leadership of society. To get rid of the relations that had existed prior to then that prevented them from emerging, prevent this new capitalist society from bursting through. That is what happened here. And so wasn't Jean Locke and Rousseau. It was our goal, it was our bodies, our resources that fueled this thing that created the wealth of Europe and now and North America. And so it wasn't because we were less civilized or less civilized that we don't have anything. It may be because, unless you want to equate civilization with the kind of barbarism that Europe visited upon the rest of us. And if we want to, we can talk about that. Although, it, you know, I think it leads us into a subjective area. But the kinds of things that we had never seen this kind of thing. None of us had ever seen this. I mean, the Europeans trained dogs to eviscerate us, you know, I mean, to just tear our intestines out and things like that. When they came to the Americas, the Spaniards, you know, there were no horses here. And so if a Spaniard wanted to go from one place to another, he'd just jump on the back of one of the indigenous people and ride them to where, I mean, it was worse than that. I won't even get into the details because it's terrible, the kinds of things that they did here and throughout the world to us. And there's a reason for that. I mean, I come from a community where nationalists attribute that to Europeans not being mutants, not being of the human family, but I don't think that is the reason for it. I think there's a whole different kind of development that emerged in Europe and what Cheikh Anta Diop, you have a book up there by Diop, don't you?
Yeah.
Would refer to as the between the northern and southern craters of civilization. I think there's a whole different kind of development that created a different kind of personality. That because anybody here ever grew up listening to the story of the grasshopper and the ant? Because this was when I was growing up. This was a horrible story that was taught when I was growing up. And the story was that the grasshopper was this happy-go-lucky kind of creature who just always was about having a good time, and the ant was hard working and working all the time and storing resources, because the ant was smart. The ant knew that winter was coming, and the ant warned the grasshopper, when winter comes, you're not going to have anything, and I'm going to have everything because I'm storing it, and you're going to die in the winter, and I'm not going to give you anything, you know. And the story was, the moral of the story is that you should work hard, be thrifty, and save for a later day. But that's not what I got out of the story when I was a kid. I could not believe it, because the ant really didn't give the grasshopper anything. That, I couldn't believe. How could somebody be so cruel? You know this guy is going to die, and you're going to say, well, because you didn't work hard like I did, I'm going to let you die. To me, that was cruel. But if you are in circumstances where nature is cruel in that fashion, and where survival is always tenuous, I think it shapes a personality differently than what happened with a lot of us who live in what Diop referred to as the southern cradle. I think that's a better explanation for it than the mutation question. Anyway, after the revolution, we can set up universities. That is the issue thoroughly, you know, but so we had to try to come to some kind of understanding about the world. And I did, you know, in looking to understand this world, I had to come up with some kind of understanding. I was never satisfied with the concept of racism. Like as I was growing up, I would hear people, in fact, I remember when this became a quite common concept, racism, you know, like, it's racism that we are confronted with. It never made sense to me. It didn't have a better thing to call it, because the whole concept of racism made the problem what white people thought about me. And that was not my problem, because frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn what white people think about me. What I care about is that if white people don't like me, they have enough power to do something bad to me. It's the power that's the problem, and not what's in their brain. And I think it was Henry Kissinger who once said that power is an aphrodisiac. And if you got enough power, people who don't like you today will love you tomorrow. And if you don't believe it, see how people are learning to love China and other forces who yesterday were powerless. You know, and Malcolm X used to say that people used to say of China that mockingly, you don't have a Chinaman's chance. But they don't say that about China anymore, because as he said, China's got more chances than most of us, right? And the thing is, I could never be satisfied with this whole concept of racism, so it became necessary to start struggling to understand the world. I couldn't be satisfied with the Marxist explanation of the stair-step development, and especially when I've become, through this concept of primitive accumulation, I have become simply a footnote to explain the development of somebody else. It doesn't say a damn thing about why I am starving and dying. I've become just a footnote. It doesn't say anything about the rest of the peoples. Do you understand what I'm saying? And so it became necessary to start trying to find out, to try to understand this thing, even as we are fighting for it, because at some juncture it becomes clear to you, you've got to know what you're fighting for. I remember cursing Malcolm, you know, because who became one of the most important ideologues in my own life, Malcolm X, you know, because I couldn't find the kinds of explanations that I needed. Why was this problem happening? And so it is that forced me to try and learn some things about theory. I start off with the contradictions in life that force me to try to fight against this thing, and then at some juncture it becomes clear that I'm not sure exactly what it is I'm fighting against. I talk about fighting against the white man on the one hand, but then in my own community, there's this chump who's always snitching to the white guy, who works for the white guy, who's got some kind of interest, it seems, just like this white guy, in keeping me where I am. So my racial analysis, it doesn't hold water. It won't help me. I mean, there's Papa Doc Duvalier, who is oppressing and murdering my people in Haiti. There are people like Joseph Mobutu, who helped the CIA murder Patrice Lumumba, one of the greatest African revolutionaries, etc., who dominates and destroys African people. The racial analysis just wouldn't hold water. I needed something more than that. And so this is the thing that made me have to struggle for theory. And also the Marxist analysis didn't help me, because it did not offer an explanation. Because the Marxist explanation, here's what Marx said. He said that wage slavery in Europe needed as a pedestal slavery pure and simple in the New World. Wage slavery, that is capitalist relations in Europe, required as a pedestal slavery pure and simple in the New World. The obvious thing here then, if you want to get rid of capitalist and capitalist relationship, then what do? You kick the pedestal out from under it. So it became, as brilliant as Marx was, he comes up with this misnomer. He says, wage slavery in Europe requires slavery pure and simple in the New World, and in the New World, therefore, somehow we have to make the struggle that's led by the industrial working class to overturn the capitalists. Do you see? It didn't make any sense to me, because the pedestal is still there. No matter who ends up now in charge, the pedestal is still there. And in fact, there was a second international, Communist International, where communists actually debated the question of having a socialist colonialism. Because they said, well, how can we in Europe make it unless we maintain these relationships that we've got with the colonies around the world? Where are we going to get the resources? Where are we going to get the order? Where are we going to get all these other resources we need if colonialism is dead? And it was a recognition of this relationship that exists between us and between Europe and North America. So simply coming to me and saying black and white united fight, or some other innocuous slogan, or saying fight racism, fight imperialism, it had no meaning for me. It was not helpful at all, and they were all wrong. And I could not never understand how the white working class, who I was supposed to unite with, was the guy who was always holding the lynch rope. You know, who was always the guy who was leading the charge. And then I get told by these Marxists that, well, it's because he's been duped. He's been duped by the white bosses. Well, how in the hell could the white boss dupe him to kill me, but can't dupe me to be killed by him? You know, I mean, it was just a ridiculous kind of logic. Here's the guy who says he's got the best education, the smartest, they're high up on this ladder of human development, but he's the one who's always being duped, even if as recently as the Gulf War, as it's characterized. They took polls, more than 70% of the white people wanted to go kill Iraqi Arabs, and more than 70% of the African people said, hell no. White guys are being duped. How can the white guys be duped? They got better computers, they got the internet, they got the best books, the best schools, etc., but they're too dumb to know that something is wrong with it, while the rest of us, right, who don't have access to all of this, no. It's not that they're being duped, it's because they have a material interest in things just as they are. Because as long as the Mexicans bring the damn fruit and stuff, vegetables out of the fields, and they can hit the supermarket and it's cheap for them to buy, as long as the Arabs' oil is accessible to them and it keeps the price of gasoline from going up, as long as the natives are quiet in the so-called ghettos and barrios, it's cool. It's only when there's a disruption of this relationship.
Yeah.
And that is the fundamental problem that we're confronted with. And this is the fundamental problem. I'm not making a racial analysis. I hope you understand. What I'm talking about is the people recognizing what they think are their material interests. And the reason they can think that this is in their material interest is because the philosophy that justifies their things as they are, that justifies their existence, has separated them from the rest of us, from the rest of the people on the planet. So they see themselves as the special force. They have an imperial attitude. They have imperialist attitudes. They have adopted the philosophy, the worldview of the ruling class because it's beneficial for them to do that. And so I had to find answers other than what they had. And so I went and studied Marx a lot, and I'm glad that I did. And I studied Lenin a lot, and it was helpful because Marx and the man named Engels perfected this method of investigation and analysis that's called dialectical and historical materialism. And the use of this method of investigation and analysis is incredibly powerful because it allows you to look at society in a scientific way. But the difference, just like any other scientist, just like a scientist who the other thing, but the difference is the scientist who's studying society is also a part of the society that he or she is studying. And that adds another element. Do you see? That's the subjective factor now becomes a really important factor. When you look at the books written by people like Lenin and Marx, etc., they were books which were written at a time where most of us had terrible oppression. And so we did not even have a voice, didn't have a part of the discussion, couldn't influence how the discussion was going. I'm not talking about people who were bad people. I'm talking about people who didn't, just like most people, who understand the world from the center that from where they exist, except us. Except us, because most of us have been taught to understand and see the world through the eyes of our oppressor. In fact, sometimes we can be made nervous if somebody talks about our oppression in a way that condemns the oppressor too seriously. We can be made nervous because that can't be true. Because if it were true, then they would have taught me this in the university. They wouldn't put that in the newspaper if it were true. They wouldn't put it there if it were a lie, etc. So sometimes we are made nervous even when we try to look at things from our own vantage point. But Marx was, and Engels and Lenin and people like that, they understood the universe, the place from where they stood. And without us clamoring, without him having to hear our voice, and of course the only thing that would make them hear our voice is a level of resistance that was so profound that they could not ignore it. Something like a 911, you know, so to speak. Nobody, you found in this country, for example, nobody even knew where Afghanistan was. The average beer-drinking, football-watching white guy did not even know where Afghanistan was. Didn't give a damn where Afghanistan was. I saw them discover Nicaragua. I saw them discover Vietnam, etc. But then, you know, in 2 weeks' time, they were experts on Afghanistan. They would debate you on your jobs, in the supermarkets, etc., about why it was proper to go in and kill everybody in Afghanistan and kill everybody in Iraq and all those other places. It took that, because an imperial attitude doesn't require you to understand anything about anybody in the world. They just have to understand everything about you. You don't have to understand any language. You don't speak any other languages or anything like that. They just have to learn how to speak your language. That's what it is to have an imperial attitude, and that's how folk were in America. And so, anyway, it is based on this understanding, this relationship that we live in, based on the rape and pillage, the theft of our resources, based on recognition of that, making us poor, and making Europe and North America rich, that informed a lot of what it was that I had to write.